I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, our reporter's notebook with Damien Cave and Diana Oliva Cave of the New York Times on working side by side in combat in Iraq. But first, faced with a plunge in global stock markets over fear of recession in the U.S., the Federal Reserve Bank cut a key interest rate to 3.5% just before Wall Street opened this morning, the biggest single cut in interest rates since 1982. The Dow still plunged by 400 points in the first 2 minutes after the opening bell, settling up a bit. Also this morning, the White House released a statement that the president will consider a larger economic stimulus package than the $150 billion one now in the works. Well, joining us is Nariman Baravesh. He's Chief Economist for the economic forecasting firm Global Insight. Nariman, the word of the day we understand is decoupling. Explain that for us.
Well, for a while there, a lot of European and Asian economists thought that even if the U.S. went into a recession, that they would be able to avoid it, the notion being that there was a lot of independent growth out there. I think that was a bit of a myth in the sense that there's a lot of vulnerability in Asia and Europe to a U.S. downturn, especially a U.S. recession, which we seem to be in right now.
Well, you seem to be saying that whether or not the U.S. had really decoupled from European and Asian markets, there's no question that we're recoupled now.
That's correct. Certainly in the sense that anytime there's a lot of bad news about the U.S., that there's so much of earnings, for example, of Asian and European companies tied in the U.S. We're still the biggest single market in the world economy, especially our consumer sectors. And so any recession in the U.S. means that the earnings, for example, of Asian and European companies are hurt very badly.
Well, the New York Times quotes analysts today as saying that the drop that we saw in the global market is driven by fear, not facts, that jobs in the U.S., for instance, are strong. So your thoughts?
I think there's no question but that we're heading for a recession. The big question is how bad will it be? Our best guess is it will be mild, especially given today's Fed actions, especially given that we actually expect the Fed to cut interest rates some more, and that we expect this fiscal stimulus package to kick in sometime probably late spring by the time they're done kind of passing it. So all said, you know, it will be a mild recession. So I don't think it's panic so much as the sort of waking up to the fact that, oh, yes, the U.S. is going into a recession, and, oh, yes, we're going to be hurt by it.
Well, you know, let's take some of these things we've discussed, the announced Fed rate cut. Many experts think that a low, low interest rate was what got the U.S. in trouble to begin with, creating the housing bubble.
Well, there's some truth to that, but I would say it this way. Certainly the Fed in the last recession in 2001 cut interest rates, but the problem and what created subsequent issues in housing was that they kept interest rates too low for too long, especially in 2003, 2004, well after the recession was over, well into the recovery. I suspect this Fed won't make that mistake again.
Lawmakers like Barney Frank are talking about more regulation coming out of this, you know, on the other side of this crisis, more regulation of banks and lenders. And, you know, what do you think's, you know, on the other side of this?
Inevitably, I think there will probably be more regulation, but I don't think we ran into these problems for lack of regulation. I mean, when this economy was more heavily regulated, we didn't prevent recessions. We didn't prevent stock market drops and so forth. So I'm guessing that, yes, some more regulation is needed, but I hope that they don't go overboard.
Will that help or hurt, though, the European and Asian faith in the U.S. economy?
I don't think that's going to make a big difference. Again, by the time they pass any regulation, you know, the financial markets will have moved on. So I don't think it's going to make any difference to what's going on in financial markets right now.
What do you think is going to happen? You know, you said a mild recession, but how about this, you know, the global economy and the sort of the ping pong up and down of the markets we're seeing?
I think certainly there's this financial contagion, if you want to call it that, ripple effects, sort of recoupling going on in the global economy. There's no debate about that. But in the end, we think that the rest of the world probably won't suffer quite as badly as the U.S., simply because the U.S. is where the epicenter of the problem is, where the subprime mess has been occurring. So from that perspective, the downturn in the U.S., the recession, will be bigger than what's going to happen in the rest of the world. For example, Europe, growth will slow down, no question about it, but they'll probably avoid a recession. The big question mark right now is China. What happens in China? China, so forth, is growing very rapidly, maybe in excess of 10%. The big debate is, will China really be hit hard by what's going on in the U.S.? And separately, could they, because of their own problems, their own stock market bubble, go through a real sort of hard landing, as it's been called? That is out there as a potential risk. I would say maybe about a 1 in 3 chance of something like that happening as well. If that happens in conjunction with a U.S. recession, then I could see the world going into a recession as well.
Nariman Baravich, chief economist for the economic forecasting firm Global Insight. One quick question. A couple months ago, a lot of Americans were told to diversify, put their money in global markets and not just in the U.S. market, which was struggling through the subprime crisis. Was that a bad advice then?
I don't think so. Diversification is a good long-term strategy. And my advice to a lot of investors would be don't panic. Don't rush out of the market. You know, don't buy high and sell low, so to speak. I think the prospects outside of the U.S. and places like China in the medium to long term are still very bright. But we're going to go through an adjustment in the midterm. So if you have the patience, have the sort of long time horizon, I think this global diversification is still a pretty good bet.
Nariman, thank you.
My pleasure.
And now to Iraq, where a suicide bomber blew himself up in front of a high school in Bakuba today, killing at least one person, wounding more than 20, including students arriving for class. Our next guests now know how dangerous it is to be in Iraq, but as Damien Cave wrote recently in the New York Times, before he and his wife traveled there to work, no one told us that sorrows are deep, the moments of joy electric. Damien Cave is a reporter for the New York Times. His wife, Diana, is a videographer and producer for the newspaper. They're back in the U.S. after spending a year together covering the war, and they join us now from the NPR studios in New York City to talk about all of that. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Damien, in particular, you've been a reporter for us in the past, and so we're going to ask you both to do that again today. First, because your thoughts when you hear a news report such as the one we just heard, another suicide bombing at a school.
Well, you know, it's heartbreaking. I think for us, particularly after spending as much time there as we have, you really start to care about the country and the people, and it's always sad to hear about a case like this. And for us, perhaps, it just kind of emphasizes what we felt when we were there is just that how fragile the country still feels.
With Diana Oliva Cave, you traveled through many of the neighborhoods, and I'm just wondering, you know, what is your sense of Iraq now? You've been back a couple of weeks, but you know, there's a sense here in the U.S. that the violence has abated, that the military surge worked. So what's your sense of it?
Well, it's so hard to say because things change so quickly there, and I feel like even in the short time that we've been gone, who knows, you know, it's hard to keep track of how things are changing over there. But, you know, when we left, I had to say it certainly was feeling better. I don't know. It's hard to say if it was a lasting peace that we were feeling, but the mood out in the neighborhoods, the mood out on the street was certainly better. People were going to restaurants again. But everyone felt really cautious about that optimism. You know, I think people have a really good sense of the fact that it could not last, that it could unfortunately revert back to the way it was.
And Damien, what did they say that they needed to have happen so that wouldn't happen?
I don't think that Iraqis really were sure of what it was, but there was a definite sense that the Iraqi government and that the Iraqi community itself had to somehow come together to create some kind of groundwork or foundation for what would be a peace, that ultimately it wasn't just up to the Americans, that at some point Iraqis felt that their own leaders had to step up.
This is the political surge we hear about, the lack of one.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I just want to ask you, we do want to, you know, mine more of your expertise in the area, but I just ask how it came to be that you worked together, because, Damien, I know you, well, I think you went to Iraq in the summer of 2006 first, and then Diana came. How hard a decision was it to decide to work together?
Well, it was interesting. We had worked together in Cuba for a little bit, but Iraq is so much more than that. And yes, I had been there alone in the summer of last year. And at that point, you know, I think Diana and I felt like, well, maybe it would be better to be together. And another Times correspondent was the first person to suggest it. And it was a difficult decision. But, I mean, Diana, you sort of had certain feelings about why that was something that you could do. And maybe you can speak to that.
Yeah, let's hear Diana.
Well, actually, I think the hardest decision was deciding whether or not Damien should go the first time in general. I think, you know, it's such a dangerous situation, and we kind of talked about it, and I was worried that he wasn't really understanding the real risks. So once we got past the point of understanding, okay, we want to, you know, I think I understood that he wanted to be a witness to this. He wanted to have an opportunity to go there and see what was going on and explain it to people back home. I think I respected that idea so much that I realized that I felt the same way, that if I had had that chance as well, I would want it. So yeah. When the opportunity – so when he came back from Baghdad with the idea of maybe going back together, we knew that the Times was expanding their video department and wanting to get more video up on the web. And I've been working in video and film for a long time. So we decided, you know what, maybe this is a good opportunity. Let's try and do this together. We didn't like the idea of maybe being separated for a year. Because they wanted him to make a commitment of about a year to go.
And by the way, people can see your video and hear the reporting on our website, here-now.org. And we featured some of it on the program in the past. But, you know, Damien, when you're writing about it recently in the style section of the Times, you were talking about how, you know, it was harder to see what you discovered once you were both working together is that it was harder to see your spouse at risk than yourself. And you would make decisions, you know, you would be thinking about her while you were covering, you know, really heartbreaking stories that we want to talk to you about ultimately of what was happening to the troops. But, you know, when bombs are going off, you're also thinking of each other's safety and making decisions. In one case, you asked to borrow a phone from a troop to try to ward off Diana from following in your footsteps because there'd been a landmine. And I'm wondering, if I were your editor at the Times reading that, I might think, you know, I don't know if this is a good thing to have them together because they're naturally preoccupied with each other's safety.
Well, that's one piece of the story. I mean, the other piece is that you naturally have a built-in support system. You know, yeah. I can come home and talk to Diana about it in a way that nobody else there could, and I often felt very fortunate for that reason. By the same token, also, our editor actually had been a young foreign correspondent with a new husband, and so I think she understood the benefits of that as well. And frankly, it was an opportunity for the Times to have, you know, video and multimedia in a place that they hadn't had it yet. And it was something that I was excited about and that Diana was excited about. But yes, I mean, there were downsides, and there were plenty of times, you know, when Diana would be out and on her way back and I would hear a car bomb and be extremely worried and wondering until she got back in the compound where on earth she was. But that was, you know, in some ways that's just a piece of the equation. You know, for most of our time there, we were just focused on our work and on, you know, getting through it.
And Diana, you would, according to this writing, that you would sometimes get a little ticked at Damien's, well, maybe this isn't the same case, but, you know, trying to fix things and, you know, maybe being a little too worried about you. Or am I reading that wrong?
No, I mean, I wasn't so worried about him worrying about me as much as,
I mean, basically, there is a tendency, I think, I felt responsible because I was the one who had convinced her to come, and I had a hard time sort of letting go of that at first.
I just didn't want him to have to feel like he had to protect me. And, you know, I think we hadn't really worked this way in the past. We hadn't really worked together in this way in the past, and our natural relationship is for him to kind of be protect or us to be protective of each other. So right. I wasn't quite used to it in that intense of a way.
Well, in an intense situation, that's Diana Oliva Cave, a multimedia producer, Damien Cave, of course, reporter for the New York Times. When we come back, we want to talk about some of the things you saw through your lens, Diana and Damien, as you reported. What soldiers say to each other when they're wounded, just some really striking moments. We're going to do that when we come back and speak more with this husband-wife journalism team. And later in the show, opening up the Klamath River in Oregon. We'll have that as well. Back in a minute, here and now. We're back with more from New York Times journalist Damien Cave and his wife, Diana Oliva Cave. They're back in the U.S. after a year covering the war in Iraq together. And Damien, I want to start with, what you saw there, because, you know, your reportage has been terrific, but sometimes some of the little details, I'm sure, have to be left out, you know, when you're trying to get the hard news facts in. And one of them jumped out at me. You were covering the terrible story, remember, that was a landmine that killed Sergeant Justin Wisniewski. You were on patrol with his unit, and many were wounded. And you write about what soldiers say to other soldiers when they're wounded.
I mean, the thing that was really amazing in that moment was the mix of anger and love was what kind of came out intense and raw. You know, the medic was working really hard on a bunch of these guys who were wounded. And there was one who was in clearly a lot of pain. It had been very bloodied. And a couple of the guys said to him, you know, hey, listen, man, if you're in pain, you're doing all right. And from that, it just kind of flowed into just real expressions of love. You know, one guy said, hey, I love you, man. And he kept saying it so much so that the wounded guy eventually said, well, hey, cut that out. And And he said, hey, man, I can say I love you if I want to. And it was just sort of this really beautiful exchange of camaraderie and war. And, you know, it's a cliche, but it's so true for these guys who work so closely together. Yeah. And for us as journalists, in many cases, you know, we felt honored just to be a part of the of moments, you know, however horrible they were, to be able to show and express and see some of that.
Diana, as we said, your videos are on our website, here-now.org. They were produced for The New York Times. Just things that you saw through your lens, you know, images that are with you now. And by the way, do they, you know, what's it like to be back? Do they pop up in dreams? I mean, how are you parsing
that? I have to say, I was pretty lucky in my experience. I didn't have to witness anything incredibly traumatic and awful like Damien did. A lot of those images were shot by Damien himself or other reporters who had cameras with them when they were out in the field. My experience was a lot better than that. I went on patrols with troops, and I think, you know, just getting to see them interacting with Iraqis, getting to see the camaraderie between the men was really incredible. I mean, the Iraqi children, getting so excited to see a woman with the video camera with the troops. Those were the kinds of things that stay with me, really.
In fact, we have some sound from a video when you went neighborhood to neighborhood and did sort of a survey to see what effect the surge was having. And this is some video that you shot, I think I've got this right, in a park near the Green Zone, and there's a young girl. And Damien, you'll be
Tabarak.
Narrating. What was that?
Her name is Tabarak.
Uh-huh.
She's our little star.
Okay, well, let's listen to her, Damien, narrating the video.
Even in a place that symbolizes innocence and escape, the children seem almost proud of the violence they've experienced. Tabarak was cheered by her friends for using a big word like displaced. She was kicked out of her home in Saidiya when her family received a threatening letter with a bullet in the envelope. Being a victim has become a badge of honor.
That's Damien Cave narrating video. Did you, Diana Oliva Cave, take that video?
Yeah.
That
day I had gone out with one of the photographers because we knew that we were going to be working on this big surge piece and wanted to do a survey of these different neighborhoods. And so we wanted to capture some images of that. So me and a photographer named Johan Spanner went out to this park along with our interpreters and some guards and just wanted to meet and see what was going on in the park. So that's how I met her. And she was very precocious. She was came right up to us and wanted to talk. So,
well, you mentioned interpreters. One of your Iraqi colleagues was the interpreter Khalid Hassan. He was killed last summer. People came up and shot him in his car. He was a target because he was an Iraqi working with Americans. We've talked to other journalists who it seems so important to let Americans know the sacrifices these people have made.
It's so true. I mean, we work every day in Iraq with a group of interpreters, male and female, of every sect, and they go out on the streets in places that sometimes we cannot go, and we often work very closely with them into the late hours of the night. And we've become very close to them, and you hear them talk about their families and the struggles they've gone through, and it just connects us to the story in a way that I always hope that Americans at home can understand and can feel.
Well, who was he? Who was he?
He was this just big lug of a guy who was 23 and in many ways was an anomaly among Iraqis because he loved pop culture intensely and just kind of loved being alive. I mean, the thing that was so heartbreaking for all of us when he died is just we couldn't possibly imagine that someone so full of life could be gone.
Yeah, Diana, we understand your cook also asked you guys if he could fit in your suitcase when you went home or another alternative, find someone who looks just like me in the U.S. and steal their passport.
Yes.
Are you trying to get people here? And also, are you thinking of going back?
I think that it's never off the table about to go back. I think you can't really go to Iraq and spend a bunch of time there and meet these people and not feel like you want to get back there at some point, whether it's to continue covering the war or hopefully cover what happens after the war.
But will you go together?
It's definitely possible. I mean, we've talked about even in the future, you know, even if we have a family, you know, maybe we'd be in it would be safe enough for us to bring, you know, a family back one day.
One day, but I can't imagine. Do you imagine that one day is soon?
I unfortunately don't think that it's soon, but I think we're hopeful that one day in the future, whether that's, 10 years or more, we'd like to go back and witness it in a good place.
Yeah. And we do stay in touch with the people there. I mean, just the other day, we got emails from some of the folks in the Bureau, some of our Iraqi friends, about that story. And, one of our friends is constantly asking for stamps of, American Hollywood stars. So, we're sending some of those back with some other people. And, I hope that we continue to hold on to those bonds, and I think we will.
You have to remember, we live with these people, so it's you just form really close bonds with people. So you hope for the best for them, and you hope that one day you'll be able to reunite with them.
Yeah. That's New York Times journalist Damian Cave and Diana Oliva Cave. Again, to see their work, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Back in the U.S. after a year covering the war in Iraq together. I want to thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Taking a quick look ahead, tomorrow on Here and Now, saving money as well as souls, with 85% of Catholic dioceses reporting cases of embezzlement. Villanova University is starting up an MBA program for priests. We'll learn more about that. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, our thoughts on a footcast on a quarterback. That's after the news, Here and Now. An unusual coalition of government agencies, Native Americans, farmers, and fishermen in Oregon and California have hammered out an historic agreement to remove four dams from the Klamath River in what would be the largest dam removal and river restoration in the nation's history. The only hitch? Well, the utility that owns the dams hasn't signed on to the agreement, and it's not clear who's going to pay for the dam removal, but as they say, the devil's in the details. Our next guest writes that the agreement, if it goes through, would bring an unlikely peace to the warring factions on the river. Once the third largest producer of salmon on the West Coast, the Klamath River now produces more environmental crises than fish. Peter Sleeth wrote those words in The Oregonian. He's an editor at the paper, and he joins us on the line. And Peter, put this in perspective for us. Why are there warring factions? What are the issues here?
Well, there's more issues on the Klamath River than fish. It's riven by politics that range from family farms and its upper reaches to tribal, Native American tribal interests down near the mouth of the river and need for power up and down the entire length of the river.
So there are people who need the water to what, fuel hydroelectric dams? How does the water factor into power?
Well, there's a half dozen dams on the river itself, but there's four that are central here that generate some level of power for Pacific Power Corps, which is a subsidiary of Warren Buffett's Mid-American Holdings. Those dams are what the tribes and the government officials want removed to facilitate the movement of salmon back up and down the river. The salmon have been blocked for decades from moving up and down the river by these dams. There's no fish ladders on them.
So how big a deal is it that these different parties came to an agreement?
I think historic's a fair way to describe it. These folks have been fighting among each other for decades, particularly the irrigated farmlands up at near the headwaters of the river, and there are thousands upon thousands of acres of former wetlands there that are now irrigated farms from the Klamath. Yeah. Those farmers are extremely concerned they're going to lose their water rights, and if there is dams taken down and flows increase for the purpose of the salmon.
Well, and so why would they agree to an agreement to take the dams down?
Because everybody's been fighting so long, it's gotten so nasty. There was a drought in 2001 that even had Vice President Dick Cheney interfering to try to get water to these farmers, that it's just become impractical for the river to even work as a political as well as a natural entity. And everyone realized something had to be done to fix the Klamath.
Yeah. Well, we want to get to the utility companies, which actually own the dams, but how were the farmers, for instance, assuaged? What in the deal, how were they promised that they might have water for their crops if, in fact, the dams that provide some irrigation might be taken down?
Well, this is the very issue that has a lot of conservationists up in arms over this deal. The farmers will get allotted guaranteed amount of water every year. In addition, and this is very important, they get subsidized electrical rates because they pump all of this water through the canals and to some extent out of the ground. that has conservation is very upset. These are large bird sanctuaries, national wildlife refuges up in the same area as the farms. They farm in the national wildlife refuges, and the conservationists do not want farming locked in the upper reaches. They want to start trying to bring some of this wild land back into a wild state.
Right. So, you know, just because these groups have come together, there are still other groups that are upset about the deal. But let's talk about the utility companies, because they own the dams. Can anyone take them down without the permission of the utility companies?
Not legally. The Pacific Power is in a conundrum. They only generate about less than 2% of the power for their company wide out of the Klamath River Basin. These are antiquated dams without fish ladders. They're up for relicensing, and they're certain to be required to put fish ladders in. That'll cost them in the neighborhood of $300 million. But if that's going to cost them $300 million, the federal government estimates it's going to cost only $120 million to actually remove the dams. So there's some economic interest to Pacific Core, to remove these dams, but they want to get the best deal out of this they can.
Yeah. Well, and what do you think is going to happen? Again, you have formerly warring groups like fishermen and farmers that have come together to sign an agreement declaring they want the dams down. You have the utility company that actually has to, you know, give the okay, and you've got some, you know, someone's got to pay for it, perhaps the government. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, it's speculation, of course, but it seems to me that Pacific Power has a lot of reasons to take down these dams in the long run. The question is, who's going to pay for all of that? Congress? Is it going to be the states? Is it going to be Pacific Power? And all of that, I think, will get hammered out, I think, this year. When dams start coming down is another question.
Yeah. A couple questions. Why do people care so much about the fish population? I mean, obviously, fish industry is important, but sometimes industries have to change and shift. So why do people care, first of all, so much about the fish?
Everybody cares for a different reason. I mean, out here, a salmon is as iconic as a tall, old-growth Douglas fir. It represents what the area once was and what people like to envision it as. On a more practical level, there's a commercial fishing fleet off the Pacific coast that depends on the salmon to make a living. Mm-hmm. There are Indian tribes up and down the Klamath River that depend upon the salmon for both nutritional sustenance, but also spiritual and cultural sustenance. Yeah. And there's conservationists who believe that we've severely damaged our environment, and we have a unique chance. In fact, this would be the biggest removal of dams in the nation's history to alter that course.
Yeah. And the river itself, it's pretty wild in parts, we hear.
It's very remote. It's difficult to get to the banks of most of the river. It can be very wild. Lots of rattlesnakes and rocks and grass. It's tough country. It's cattle country. It's back country.
And yet it's very important to a lot of people.
It is important to a lot of people, if nothing else, for its symbolism as a wild and scenic river that perhaps we can take back to what it once was.
Peter Sleeth, editor at The Oregonian, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So everyone here in New England is a Twitter about a picture of our Patriots quarterback Tom Brady walking, some say gingerly, into his girlfriend's New York apartment holding flowers and wearing a walking cast. That's his plant foot. The Boston Herald says if he can't push off it, he can't get zip on the ball. Come to think of it, during last Sunday's win against the Chargers, didn't it look like Brady wasn't getting the proper help from his plant foot? How's he going to face the Giants' reborn Eli Manning in the Super Bowl without his plant foot? People who've never uttered the phrase plant foot now can't stop talking about it. Brady told a local sports station it's just a nick. At NFL rumor sites, there's speculation that Brady's former girlfriend, the mother of his child, broke his foot. How immature. Let's look closely. First of all, in his hood and sunglasses, ducking paparazzi as he makes his way into Gisele Bundchen's apartment, Brady looks alarmingly like On the Lam mob boss Whitey Bulger. But more important, maybe it's me. But while everyone else is looking at the foot, I'm looking at the flowers. A gorgeous arrangement of white roses, baby's breath, with a little green fern for accent, and perhaps is that radicchio I see? Tom Brady's plant foot may be hurting, but his taste in plants, exquisite. Tomorrow, newsman Tom Brokaw, you're listening to Here and Now. the envelope, please.
The films selected as the Best Picture nominees for 2007 are Atonement, Juno, Michael Clayton, No Country for Old Men, and There Will Be Blood.
That's Oscar-winning actress Kathy Bates reading this year's nominations for the 50th Annual Academy Awards announced today. The awards ceremony is scheduled for February 24th, but as we saw, the Writers Guild strike turned the recent Golden Globe Awards into a glorified press conference, so the Oscars show may also lose its glitz. Wesley Morris of the Boston Globe joins us for more from his perch in Park City, Utah, where he's covering the Sundance Film Festival. And Wesley, did any themes jump out for you out of the nominations today?
The two movies that got the most nominations, There Will Be Blood and No Country for Old Men, are remarkably unhappy.
Yeah, we've spoken of that on this program. No Country for Old Men, for instance, not one of the good guys wins.
Right.
I'm just going to say it's also a really good year among those nominees for endings. Atonement is a movie I didn't care for necessarily, but I mean, it has an interesting ending, as does There Will Be Blood, and so does No Country for Old Men. I think the sort of satisfaction people want from a movie being tied up very easily by the time it's over is turned on its head with most of the nominees.
Well, that sort of happened in Ratatouille, which was nominated along with Persepolis in the animated film category. What surprises did you feel?
The biggest surprise, actually, is Tommy Lee Jones being nominated for Best Actor. When In the Valley of Eli came out, it's a movie nobody saw, but when it came out, it seemed like he was a sure thing to win critics' awards, but he didn't. And so his showing in that category is a big surprise. Another surprise is Jason Reitman being nominated for Best Director. He made Juno.
I want to comment on that. First, just backing up, Tommy Lee Jones, he's now competing against George Clooney and Michael Clayton, Daniel Day-Lewis in There Will Be Blood, Johnny Depp and Sweeney Todd, and
Viggo Mortensen for Eastern Promises.
Yeah, but you mentioned Juno. This is a comedy about a teenager who gets pregnant, decides to give the child away. The film was also nominated for Best Picture. Ellen Page, the teen, was nominated for Best Actress, as you mentioned, the director nominated as well. Here's Ellen Page breaking the news to her mom, played by Allison Janney of West Wing fame.
I'm pregnant.
Oh, God.
I'm going to give it up for adoption, and I already found the perfect couple. They're going to pay for the medical expenses and everything, and 30-year-odd weeks, we can just pretend that this never happened.
I liked, you know, up to a point. I think the minute my brain starts engaging with it, I can't abide it. It's not so much that teen pregnancy can't be made light of, but I think the way this particular movie does it, it turns that dilemma into a kind of fantastical, almost fairy tale like experience. And it's just, I mean, there's very little reality about the hassles of being 16 years old and pregnant in a small, you know, blue collar town.
Well, another film that sort of has some humor with a very serious family issue actually came out of Sundance last year. It's The Savages. Laura Linney was nominated for Best Actress. This is the film about the dysfunctional brother and sister who go home to take care of their father. Here's Laura with her dad, who's played by Philip Bosco.
He's not that kind of doctor, Dad. He's a professor.
I thought my boy was a doctor.
Doctor of philosophy, PhD, teaches college.
Medicine?
No, drama.
That's Laura Linney. We mentioned Ellen Page. Who else is nominated for Best Actress?
Marion Cotillard, who plays Edith Piaf in La Vie en Rose. Julie Christie playing an Alzheimer's patient in Away From Her. And the last nominee is Cate Blanchett. She played Queen Elizabeth in Elizabeth, which came out in 1998. She got nominated for that, and now she's been nominated again for playing the same part in the sequel.
Well, good year for Cate Blanchett. She also got nominated for her supporting role as Bob Dylan, I'm Not There, right?
Yeah.
And there's so much money involved with Oscar night, advertising, viewership. Do you think there's going to be extra pressure on the Writers Guild to wrap things up by then?
You know, I don't think so. I mean, I think that the thing that the Writers Guild wants more than anything is for the Oscars not to happen, to bring the most, to sort of underscore the gravity of the situation for them.
Again, the Writers Guild of America, they want to be paid for their work that goes on to new technology like the Internet.
The real drama, actually, is whether the show's going to happen, not even who's going to win. Gil Cates, the producer of the show, says it's going to go on regardless of what happens. I mean, it's unclear what that show's going to look like, because there won't be any actors on it, because the actors won't cross the picket line.
And accepting Cate Blanchett's mother. Boston Globe movie critic Wesley Morris speaking to us about today's Oscar nominations. Wesley, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
We'll be back in 1 minute with jazz singer Holly Cole here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Jazz singer Holly Cole has had a huge success in her native Canada with 2 platinum and 4 gold albums. She sold over 1 million records worldwide. Now she's taking on the U.S. with a CD chock full of standards, including songs by Cole Porter and Irving Berlin. For the Moon. It's from the CD Holly Cole, which is being released today. And Holly herself joins us from the CBC studios in Toronto. Welcome.
Hi, Robin.
And did I hear, we're based here in Boston, that this is a very important part of your jazz career?
Oh, Boston, absolutely. My brother studied jazz piano at Berkeley in Boston. And when I was 15, I hitchhiked, much to my parents' chagrin, down to Boston to visit him. And I hung out there, and it was where I really discovered jazz music and how interesting, complex, warm, intimate it was. I was lucky enough to be so young as to do that, because I see so many kids nowadays who are searching for what they crave, what they love, what they want to do. And I found it at a pretty young age.
Well, let's listen to your sort of, you know, tribute to jazz. This is your version of Irving Berlin's Be Careful, It's My Heart.
Sweetheart of mine, it's more than a valentine. Be careful, it's my heart. It's not my watch you're holding, it's my heart.
Why that particular song?
When I make CDs, Robin, I really like to have a focus, and so I often find, I look for a theme. For this record, I made a list of, I don't know, 9 or 10 subjects that I thought I would explore. And I deleted them, and I came down to the subject of denial or self-deception. This song to me was kind of had a duality of the realization of the fact that this person really isn't in love with you. You're in love with them, but they're actually not in love with you. And at one time, maybe you thought they were when you were in denial, and you're sort of in a period of discovery, I think, about it. And it's quite melancholy in that way, but also very healthy and much better than not realizing it.
Mm. We've read that there was an article of, what was the title? It's not that Holly Cole doesn't like computers, but she just doesn't want it to ruin the mood. And there was something about how you want the songs to be real, you know, as, you know, their first take. In fact, let's listen to, this is Charade by Johnny Mercer and Henry Mancini. Many people may remember it from the Cary Grant, Audrey Hepburn film. Let's listen to a little.
When we played our charade, we were like children posing, playing at games, acting out names, guessing the parts we played.
Now, Holly Cole, are you listening to that now and thinking, oh, I should have done this here or that there? Or, but is that okay?
Of course. No, I love it, and I'm very proud of it. But of course, I mean, I'm in a constant state of self-criticism. But we recorded it all at the same time, and all the horns were on, like, a couple of mics, so things can't be fixed and stuff. What I also like, though, about that is that there's kind of bumps and stuff and scrapes and things that, to me, are the jewels in a lot of ways.
And you didn't think that at first. You were going to go home and re-record some passages, and then you thought, oh, no, it's better with the rough patches.
Well, you're absolutely right, Robin, and that was to do with myself, though, because I recorded in a booth. The band played out in the big room, and I recorded in a booth so that I could go and fix things. Greg Cohen, who I have to say, he played bass in the record a lot of the tunes, and when we finished, you know, recording, he said, wow, he said, well, you know what, you know, it didn't even matter that you were in the vocal booth. The takes are great and stuff, and I said, well, you know. So I went and fixed, and I spent weeks, a month maybe, doing it. And then I was like, great, everything's clean, everything's, you know, exactly what I wanted to do. And then I listened to it, and I went, well, that sucks. Because I guess I had robbed it of its essence in a way. I phoned Greg Cohen and he said, well, how does this sound now? And I said, well, you know, he would never say I told you so, because he's a doll. But You know, he was right. Like, it sounds much better. The spirit is there. And that's why there's mostly first takes, second takes, third takes. It's when everyone's fresh and excited about it, and it's not really, really clean. And I kind of think that's a great thing. It's old school.
Well, here in the middle of all this old school, all these American classics as well, is a Holly Cole piece. It's the one that you wrote. It's called Larger Than Life. Let's hear a little first.
I seen the pyramids at Giza, that tilty tower in Pisa, but baby, they just don't do what you do, 'cause you're larger than life.
That's Larger Than Life by Holly Cole. Reread that there's something about Cole Porter's lyrics that appeal to you and play a part in this song.
Sure. This song, I mean, although it's a new song, it sounds like a song from the period. And Cole Porter is a huge influence to me. And I think there's no doubt that he was an incredible genius. One of the reasons why I glean from this era of songwriting is that I think that the craft is so high. I'm really not an old-fashioned girl, Robin, at all. And a lot of the values, especially gender issues, and a lot of the values from that time period are not my values at all. But the craft of songwriting is so high that I find myself gravitating towards that time period of songwriting.
It's the wrong time and the wrong place, though your face is charming. It's the wrong face. It's not a his face, but such a charming face. Whoa, it's all right with me.
Well, and we should note that in and among all these largely American classics and a piece from you, suddenly there's Antonio Jobim.
Yeah.
You're throwing the whole thing off. I mean, why did you add, and we'll listen as we go, why did you add this?
Well, I've heard this song a number of times, and anyone who's a Bossa Nova fan will know this song. It's quite famous. But I always heard it sung very quickly, because the song is essentially a list. It's a list of things. It's a list of things in life. Some of the things in the list are very mundane. Some of the things in the list are quite profound. Some of them are provocative. It's all the things that we have in life. And I wanted to do it not in a Bossa fashion, but in this other time feel, and also to slow it down so that you could have a moment to sort of absorb how these different things that exist in our world compare to one another.
The foot, the ground, the flesh and the bone, the beat of the road, a slingshot stone, a fish, a flash, a silvery glow, a fight, a bet, the range of a bow, the wood of the wind, the steps in the hall, a scratch, a lump. It is nothing at all.
So, where are you from in Canada? The Maritimes?
That's the east coast of Canada. I'm from the Maritimes, and everyone there talks so fast. I can hardly even, when I go back there, I can hardly understand my relatives. And I get teased relentlessly by my boyfriend about my hard. I say hard instead of hard. You know, say hard, like it's a hard.
But see, to me, you don't sound Canadian in that we are, you know, trained to think the Canadians are going to say a boot and oot, and you don't sound like that.
Well, you know what is funny is that actually no Canadians actually do say a boot, unless you're talking about footwear. But but we say a boat instead of about.
Yeah.
But it gets exaggerated into a boot.
That's Canada's Holly Cole. Her new CD is called Holly Cole, and that's her version of Antonio Carlos Jobim's Waters of March. Holly, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Robin.
A float, a drift, a flat, a wing, a hawk, a quail, the promise of spring, the bed of the well, the end of the line, dismay in your face, it's a loss, it's a find, a snake, a stick, it is John, it is Joe, it's a thorn in your hand and a cut in your toe. Well, the riverbank talks of the waters of March, it's the promise of life, it's the joy in your heart.